You're listening to the New Evangelicals Podcast. Hey everyone, welcome to the New Evangelicals Response. I'm Tim, the host of this segment. Join us every Wednesday as we respond to commentary on the pressing issues of our day, offering a thoughtful response rooted in love, justice, inclusivity, and of course, non-dehumanization. Let's get into it. Hello, friends. How are we doing? Welcome to another episode of TNE Responds. Different type of format. Usually I'm responding to a video. This time I'm responding to some pretty big news. Now, this is going to be a two-part series. Part one is me and my friend Dan Koch. He's the host of the You Have Permission podcast, talking about the topic at hand. And then episode two, part two, will come out next Wednesday with Dr. Angela Parker. There's been some very big news in the Christian academic world. Richard Hayes, one of the leading ethicists of Christian thinking in our modern era, is releasing a book in September that talks about his change of heart from a non-affirming to an affirming stance. This is a big deal. There's a lot of layers to this. And I wanted to give you some kind of big overview of how different people are hearing this news and all the different layers to what's actually happening. So part one is me and Dan talking about this. We get into a lot of the nuance here. And then part two will come out next week on Wednesday with Dr. Angela Parker. Different type of response, I know, but this news was so big. I really wanted to dedicate our own responding type episode to it. And then we'll get back into our usual format after that. I have some more videos I'm working on to bring to you. As always, friends, thank you so much for watching this on YouTube or listening to it on podcast. If you want to support our work, you can share this episode. You can subscribe to our YouTube channel. You can subscribe to our podcast. You can rate and review, like and subscribe, the usual stuff. Leave a comment. I would love your thoughts on this, by the way, as we're talking about the conversation. I would love to hear what you have to say. And then if you want to support our work financially, we are a nonprofit organization holding space for thousands, tens of thousands of people as they navigate a better path forward in their faith. Donating is the way that makes this work possible because we don't do anything behind a paywall. We are paywall free. Everything we do is totally accessible to the public. We rely on the generosity of people like you to make this work possible via donations. All donations made in the U.S. are tax deductible. Thank you so much, friends, for listening, for watching. It means the world. Check out this conversation, part one of my discussion with Dan Koch. Part two comes out with Dr. Angela Parker next week. Talk to you all soon. Sweet. All right. Well, Dan Koch, good to see you again. You and I have done quite a few podcast crossovers in the past, and we've hung out a few times at Theology Beer Camp, which we're going back to again in October. I'm super pumped for that. Great to be with you on both of our podcasts. So welcome.
Yeah, thanks. This is airing on both the New Evangelicals and the You Have Permission. The midweek slot on the both midweek shows.
Yeah.
You are more diligent about those midweek releases than I am, but we do them every other week, maybe 3 weeks a month. We'll have something. Mm. And this felt like a good use of that.
I totally agree. I mean, just for the sake of my audience who might be a newer listener on my end, why don't you go ahead and introduce yourself so folks know who you are?
Yeah. So I'm Dan Koch. I am a licensed therapist. And I am a liberal Christian podcaster like yourself. You might say progressive Christianity. I identify more with like old school mid-century liberal Protestantism, the Paul Tillich Schleiermacher side of things. But I focus a lot on psychology specifically and other social sciences and other sciences. And my kind of tagline for You Have Permission is taking both Christianity and the modern world very seriously.
Mm. Great. Well, it is kind of full circle for me because I told you this before, but when I first started really rethinking, what does the Bible or the Christian tradition say about queer inclusion? It was your podcast. I think it's one of you said it's one of your most listened to episodes.
It's by far, it's easily number one. Yeah.
Okay. And who was the person you had on? What was it?
J.R. Daniel Kirk.
Yeah.
Also, he goes by Daniel Kirk as well. Yeah.
That, you know, I should reach out to him and see if he'll come on my podcast as well, because that episode was like the first big domino of like, wait a second. This is very compelling. I have things to chew on. Me and my wife are listening to it in the car. We were on some trip. And so it's very cool now to have you on the show and for us to be friends. It means a lot. And just so your audience knows, my name is Tim. I'm the creator of the New Evangelicals. We're a nonprofit organization. We do podcasts and social media content. The end. So that's what I do.
Can I say, actually, one of the things that I really value about what you guys do is you guys have a resource that I regularly point people to that helps people find each other in person. There's like a geographical map, and you know, you have permission. We're not at the same organizational level that you're at. And so I don't have something like that. And, you guys do. And so that's also something that you provide, which is truly rare in sort of progressive, like deconstruction, post-evangelical world. Yeah.
And arguably one of the greatest needs. I'm sure, like you, I hear it all the time. Like, is there anyone in my area? Is there a church I can attend? Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, I have to get better at talking about the community resources that we offer because I don't talk about them a whole lot publicly. It slips my mind, to be honest. But yes, we do have a website you can sign up. It's totally free. Everything we do is paywall free. We don't charge a dollar for anything. We're all donation based. And you can make an account and you can sign up on our members map and just see who's in your area. You can send them a private DM. Quite a few folks have met each other through the map. I think there's over 4,000 people on the map right now. So it's a very cool resource. Yeah.
I'll tell you how it would stop slipping your mind if you became a therapist and had like daily or at least weekly reminders that the people you were seeing needed connection with like-minded individuals that accepted them.
Yeah.
Then I think you would not forget so easily about that resource.
Yeah, that's a totally fair point. So the reason we're having this conversation is something happened in the academic Christian world where, and I gotta be honest, Dan, I think you know way more about the backstory here than I do. So I'm going to try and give my best.
Do you want me to set it up?
I want to lob the ball over to you. Go ahead.
All right. Richard B. Hayes.
Yeah.
Probably now he's professor emeritus. He's in his early 70s, I think, at Duke Divinity School.
Yeah.
Duke Divinity School is one of those schools that is respected, we might say, like on the left and right. Mm. And I think that that's what kind of makes all of this interesting is that Richard B. Hayes, he's a New Testament scholar, and specifically he's an ethicist. And so he is talking about biblical ethics around whatever questions we might have, ethical questions about money, power, sex, greed, you know, like whatever, name it, race, you know. So that's the kind of stuff like the practical morality of the Bible and the Christian life. And his big seminal work was called The Moral Vision of the New Testament, came out 28 years ago in 1996.
Yeah.
Now, my understanding is that other than maybe N.T. Wright, Hayes has been probably the most widely respected New Testament scholar to hold a non-affirming position. Mm. Now, a lot of people have gotten on me in my comments section on Instagram when I've posted a couple of videos about this because they're like, you're insane. You know, there are all these respected New Testament scholars who are non-affirming. All Christians are non-affirming, things like that.
Yeah. Right.
But those scholars don't tend to be respected outside of conservative circles. Like if you are a New Testament ethicist at Dallas Theological Seminary,
right,
nobody at Union Theological Seminary respects you. So that doesn't mean that you're wrong.
Newsflash.
Right? Or Princeton or whatever. Like that doesn't mean that you're wrong. Like that's not an argument that he's right or wrong. But in terms of wide influence, like taken seriously by liberals, progressives, and taken extremely seriously by conservatives. I've seen, this is anecdotal, but people have forwarded me emails from, you know, pastors of theirs citing the moral vision of the New Testament as like the gold standard for these kind of more, you know, moderates, basically, right? People who maybe they go to Baylor and they genuinely love gay people, whether or not they are affirming or whether or not they feel that their job will still exist if they become affirming. Like he is like the guy for that world. Now, N.T. Wright is more famous, but N.T. Wright doesn't focus on ethics. So he will be asked about it, but he doesn't really write about it. So that's why I say other than N.T. Wright, but they're buddies. And probably my guess is that N.T. Wright holds his position as a result in part of his conversations with his friend, Richard Hayes, and Hayes's work. They're very much in alignment. And when N.T. Wright has gone on the record about this, he speaks about it in very similar terms to Hayes. So that's the backdrop. That was probably more than you wanted.
No, it's helpful. It's helpful.
But I speak quickly. Yeah. So, you know, I do it fast. Even hey, if
and we're on a podcast. We got long form content.
We got time.
I got people who are like, I love the 2 hour episodes. I'm like, are you? I don't listen to 2 hour episodes.
It's all about what you're doing. Like on a drive or doing like chores around the house, you know, the longer stuff can be great.
Totally.
Anyway, so he has now announced, written a book. It's coming out on Yale University Press. It is co-authored with his son, mm-hmm. who teaches at Fuller Seminary, and it's called The Widening of God's Mercy, and it is described by the publisher as a thoroughly biblical account of LGBTQ affirmation in the church.
Yes.
So what I would like to get into you is like how we think that that might be the case, because the argument he makes in Moral Vision of the New Testament is that like, look, the biblical writers don't approve of this. And that's basically the argument.
Right.
And embedded in that is the idea that, and therefore I don't agree with it because I must side with the New Testament authors.
Right.
So that's kind of the background. And then the book announcement has led to all kinds of ripple effects and whatever in various communities. And that's why you're talking to me, but then also talking to Angela Parker, right?
That's exactly correct. Because when I saw the book floating around on Twitter, I saw Zach Lambert post about it. I'm like, okay, this sounds like it's a really big deal. And I'm not someone who is an academic. So this person's name, to your point, I was not familiar with them. Of course, I know who N.T. Wright is. I know who David Gushee is because we overlap in the same circles.
Yeah.
But yeah, Richard Hayes, David. For me, I was like, yeah, I don't really know. And people were like, no, this guy wrote arguably the book on Christian ethics that impact millions of Christians, including other academics. I was like, whoa. Yeah. And so it is interesting, right, to have this change, especially I didn't realize that him and N.T. Wright were close because N.T. Wright, who you're right, I love N.T. Wright. I'm a huge fan of his work. I have some of his books on my shelf. I'm working on trying to interview him. But I know that he recently endorsed Preston Sprinkle's book that was responding to like 21 arguments in favor of, you know, queer inclusion. And I was so disappointed. I was like, come on, N.T. Wright. And so I don't really know if this is maybe a hopeful step forward, even for someone like N.T. Wright, if his friend comes out with this book. But yeah, it seems like it's a really big deal. And I have seen kind of a plethora of responses. And maybe that's why I wanted to ask you, Dan, is you're pretty tapped into this world in some ways even more than I am. What are the ripple effects that you've seen so far over the spectrum of the left, the moderate, and the right?
Yeah, I think that's good. So what I have seen is I'll sort of characterize some categories. I think there is what from my perspective seems to be like a silly leftward response, which is, oh, how convenient, white men can change their mind. You know, kind of like, just, to me, that's kind of lazy. You know, it can cost anybody to change their mind. You know, people, it's interesting, like conservatives have argued, oh, he's just trying to like fix his legacy for the modern world. And it's like, well, he could just as easily want his legacy to be good in the conservative world. Like, you know, like these are just sort of not arguments. Then there's something that I'm much more kind of open to, which is maybe largely from the queer Christian world or queer former Christian world, which is like, hey, this is great and all, buddy. But your work has been a foundational text for a whole lot of hatred and exclusion and all of that. Mm-hmm. So, I recognize that I value that, especially emotionally. I value it. You know, almost therapeutically, if one of these people were my client, for instance, I would validate that experience. Where I think but then the final camp is sort of where I'm at, which is to think about it strategically, because, and I recognize that I have some privilege in being able to think about it strategically because I'm not queer myself. I don't have like this book coming out or not coming out does not impact my life, my family, the way I see myself, right? It's not. The stakes are low for me.
Yeah.
But that being said, I do consider myself to be a queer ally in the space of Christianity. And strategically, I can't see this as anything but a win. This is exactly the type of person crossing to the other team, if you will, that you want. It's like Michael Jordan saying, hey, maybe Michael Jordan's too high. Maybe N.T. Wright would be Michael Jordan and this is Scottie Pippen. I don't know. So Scottie Pippen's like, hey, I'll come play for the Warriors. You can have me. And then we're like, no, we associate you with the Bulls, right? So mm-hmm. I would just say strategically, that's when I'm sort of the least compelled by some of the pushback. And I am, you know, who knows what the overall effect will be, but it seems to be right. exactly the kind of person that we want to welcome into the fold. I hope that the book is not, nobody can read it yet except the people who have endorsed it, basically. So there's no public copy available. So we don't know right. what he's going to say. And they haven't done a big press tour yet. I'm sure that will happen closer to the release, to the extent that they do any. And I really hope that he is like very clearly apologizing for that and calling out the harm yeah. done in the name of his scholarship. And to the extent that he bears responsibility for that, I think in any given case, it depends. There are probably people who are using his scholarship out of context or in an extremely hateful way or whatever. But even just used straightforwardly, it's like, yeah, you're in the wrong if you are living a queer lifestyle. And that's what the New Testament writers thought. And therefore, that's what God thinks. And that's kind of the end of the argument in the book.
Yeah, I think you really summarized all the complexity and the layers that I've been thinking through as well in so many different ways. And this is why I wanted to do a TNU Responds episode of responding to this news, right? Because it is, it feels like, yeah. like it's really a boulder in the lake and it's just creating, mm-hmm. you know, massive waves. I don't want to give away too much of my conversation with Dr. Parker. That will come out next week. But I said to her as well, what I'm going to tell you, what you just said, I really hope that somewhere, maybe it's the intro, maybe it's chapter one or whatever, but I hope that there is a sincere moment or section where Richard or, you know, Dr. Hayes is like, yeah, I know that my influence and power to shape theological understanding of this topic was wrong and caused a lot of damage. And this is almost like my act of repentance, right? By trying to repair the harm by saying, I made a mistake. I want to acknowledge that and then go the other way in favor of this position now, right? I think that would be just an amazing start to a book that hopefully, to your point, is one of the major dominoes that we can look back on in maybe a decade or two decades and say, man, there were a lot of moments leading up to this, but this book was one that really gave a lot of people permission. And here's what I mean, what I mean by this. I hear through the grapevine often, quite a few influential, maybe pastors or leaders or people even who are smaller at their church who are like, I really do have these views, but also my livelihood is tied to this and my healthcare is tied to this and I have a family and I'm trying to navigate.
It's a reality.
It's a reality. For right or for wrong, it's a reality. Yep. And I'm hoping that a book like this one breaks that open where those people can say, look, I'm standing on firm ground here. There's room for this. And now I can just come out and kind of say it without losing my livelihood. That's attached to how I provide for my kids, right? So I'm hoping that's what we see long term with a book like this.
That's my hope as well.
Hi, my name is Leanne. I live in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. I'm 65 years old, and both my husband and I grew up in a fairly conservative evangelical church. But about 20 years ago, we began to question some of the teachings in that church, and we embarked on our own process of deconstruction and reconstruction, although it didn't have a name at the time. And we have recently started attending a wonderful church that is fully affirming and fully inclusive of our LGBTQ+ siblings in Christ. And we absolutely love it. It's the best faith experience of our lives. And I so appreciate Tim and the New Evangelicals team. I so appreciate the online resource. And I have become a donor because I believe so strongly in the really important work they're doing. And I would encourage anyone listening to consider doing the same. Thank you.
I think that, you know, as I've thought about people's reactions and the reactions that I've been least open to or least convinced by, It's almost like some people are treating it like Joshua Harris, speaking of TNE Responds. Did you do any episodes on when Harris kind of came out? I'm not a Christian anymore. Oh, and by the way, pay $400 for my coaching course to help you deconstruct purity culture.
I was in the thick of it. I was watching all the comments from afar, just like, oh, Josh boy.
Popping the popcorn. So that's an example, you know, and to his whatever, maybe limited credit, he heard people on that. He pulled the course.
And
I don't know what he's up to now, you know, frankly.
Right.
A lot of these guys, you know, it seems like they feel like they have a right to like a public platform or something. And that's not really a God-given right. But, and I say that, you know, needing to be aware of that myself.
100%.
But like, that is the worst case, right? Yeah. So if Hayes was like, here, 10 steps to being an ally or whatever, he'd be like, whoa, dude. But that's not what he's done, right? Like, at least thus far, he is a biblical scholar whose job for 40 years has been to write books of biblical scholarship. And what he's done here is written another book of biblical scholarship.
Yeah.
Challenging previous positions that he held, right? And now upholding a new position through the same project, biblical scholarship. Yeah. And I think that I do think that that asks of us a different response than someone like Josh Harris, who like this is. People have to be able to change their minds. Like, what's the world like where we don't let any scholars or thinkers change their minds without nailing them to, you know, a cross of our making, so to speak?
Yeah, I will definitely say that when it comes to particularly white, liberal, heterosexual people who are critiquing this, I'm like, okay, like, whatever. When it comes to some of the people that I really respect in the queer community, especially the queer Christian community, that's when I go, okay, I want to listen here, you know, because like, what could I be missing? And it seems like there is, and I don't want to make it monolithic. Of course, it's always more complicated than what everyone might or might not think, broadly speaking. But from some of the friends that I have who I really respect their views on, it seems like most of them kind of have that both in perspective of like, man, you know, like this dude did so much damage. I'm kind of frustrated by it. I'm frustrated that's kind of getting the attention that it's getting. But pragmatically, if this pushes things forward, like we'll take the win, right? And I would hope, I mean, I don't know. I don't know how biblical scholarship works. I'm not a biblical scholar. I'll have to ask Tripp or something, but I would hope that that Richard acknowledges the work of other folks who have been doing this work for decades that have gone super unnoticed or even have been kicked out of their own faith traditions because it was too dangerous, you know? And now Richard's kind of coming in like, hey, I changed my mind. And the world's like, whoa, this is amazing. This is groundbreaking, which again, pragmatically, I'll take the win. But I also hope that there's an acknowledgement that, hey, there have been queer Christian scholars for decades doing this work. Right. In some cases, really underrepresented or kicked out of their institutions because it was too detrimental to their
work. That's what I'm so interested. Like, I'm not going to read the book because I need, you know, convincing or clarification. Right. Like, I've established my view on the issue a long time ago.
Yeah.
But I'm excited to read it because I am really curious how the Hayeses, younger and senior, are going to interact with other scholarship. Like, for instance, Dale Martin, who was a longtime professor at, I think, Yale, now retired, wrote many books, gay man, New Testament scholar, New Testament ethicist, right? Kind of, really kind of a contemporary with Hayes. Some of his work, I think, just is incredible and brilliant. Some of his work, he's even told me on past episodes, like, he's kind of poking the bear a little bit and coming up with kind of more extreme takes, you know, 80s and 90s America, AIDS crisis in the background, right? Different cultural time. And he's really, you know, kind of poking things. And it'll be interesting. Like, do they quote Martin at all? Do they quote other scholars of his ilk who come from that world? Are there perspectives of those scholars that the Hayeses have come to accept and change their mind about? I'm also curious, like, if they narrativize it a bit, like, what changed? Because what's interesting about his original book from 96 is part of that chapter on homosexuality. That's the title of the chapter. He talks about a friend of his who has, you know, I forget the language, really struggled with this stuff, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
And that friendship with that friend who himself felt he needed to be what we would now call like a side B Christian, right? Or which one's which is which?
Side B is the ones who would say, I'm gay, but I don't act on it, quote unquote, something like that. Yeah.
Yes. Side B. So he was friends, very close friends with like a side B Christian. And that was like one of the things that compelled him in his own reasoning. Mm. And what's funny is some of the conservative pushback I've seen about the book is like, he probably has a gay friend and now he's changed his mind. And it's like, okay, you obviously didn't read the original piece because he had a gay friend who was celibate. And that's like, so you can't like people hot takes about this are going to miss so much because they are going to just sort of want an easy version of it that fits their narrative.
Yeah.
And, you know, so I'm excited to actually read it and see where they go because it's a lot of options. Like, they have a lot of paths available to them. Some of which, like you're saying, really acknowledge and celebrate some of that queer scholarship. And they have another path where, you know, and then also one more thing here, Tim, is who is the book for? Who do they think it's for?
Right.
And if they think the book is for persuadable moderates,
yes,
then I actually don't think it would be in their interest to like quote Dale Martin a bunch. Mm. So even if they agree with him, like they might choose strategically not to. And that's always tough because strategy is not the same as truth telling. Like they're not the same thing. Mm. The Democratic Party trying to beat Trump is not primarily interested in telling voters the truth. Mm. They are interested in strategy. Mm. And I'm glad they are. Like that's their job. Right.
Right.
Like, I can tell the truth. I'm not a Democratic Party strategist, but they can't. They have to get people to vote. So it's complicated, I guess. I'm fucking always saying that. That's all I ever say. I'm such a killjoy, Tim. It's complicated, guys. That's my whole career.
Well, the more I do this work and the more I read, the more I'm like, yeah, no, I tend to agree. It's complicated because it's not a binary. It's not even a moral judgment in a lot of ways of like morality. Is this right or wrong? It's just, how do we navigate this? And different people, based on their experience and, of course, their sexual identity, are going to respond differently to this. And how do we hear those voices, of course, and also think about, as I'm sure they are, pragmatically speaking, can this really shift this culture that people have been fighting for decades now, right? I mean, again, I go back to even Isaac Sharp's book, The Other Evangelicals. He documents in the 70s and 80s, queer evangelicals, right? Gay men who were like, I'm a Christian and I'm an evangelical and I'm gay and this works, right? So this is not something new. This has been there all along. And I'm curious for you, do you think that this book, because it's coming from Richard Hayes and because of his influence, do you think this has the potential to really make a massive shift, particularly in these white evangelical spaces? That tends to be the primary audience. Or do you think that like the white evangelical space is going to spit him out, kind of like what they did with David Gushee, right? Or Rob Bell? Because to be fair, those people also had a lot of influence and power, but the evangelical institutions and subculture is very powerful. And I'm kind of curious in this power struggle, so to speak, which one's going to make more of an impact on the other party?
I mean, I can try a prediction, but one of the things I talk about literally every day in my therapy office with clients is that nobody knows the future.
True.
And it actually can be tremendously calming to recognize that we don't know the future.
If you're an open relational theologian, even God doesn't know the future, you know? So, how about that?
Well, I do believe that because the future doesn't exist yet. Mm. So even if God knows everything that can be known, God does not know the future because it's not here.
Boom.
God might know some things about the future. I don't know. But anyway, you got me derailed there. So I can try a prediction.
I'm just kind of curious, like based on what you know, what do you think might happen? Well,
there's something that I'm really interested kind of embedded in your question that's not so much the prediction part. So let me see if I can land this plane.
Yeah, feel free.
So in terms of a splash or a change, I think that still the majority of what we might call the gatekeepers, okay? Yeah. So these are not the rank and file suburban megachurch attendees, but these are the pastors, the board members of big churches, seminaries, and you know, anybody who sort of sees it as their job to gatekeep the truth of Christian doctrine.
Yeah.
Those
SBC leaders, people like that.
Yes. They will just, he's out of the family now. Like that's easy. Their view of the world is not going to be moved by one prominent scholar changing his mind. Yeah. Where I'm more interested in is the rank and file, the churches that are, that have attempted and maybe some of them have succeeded at sort of becoming less political in the wake of Trump and evangelicalism, there are a lot of like community churches, Bible churches, just non-denominational churches in like suburban areas that are not full of a ton of hateful people, you know, that are full of like tech workers and their families, or blue collar workers and their families, and they bring their kids, and young people especially are really have such different views around queer sexuality than older people.
Totally.
Those young people are not the gatekeepers. The gatekeepers are older. Yeah. So like, yeah, expect nothing from the gatekeepers that makes any of us happy, but right. That's not where to look. Where to look is, I don't know, call it something like the middle, you know, in the United States sort of sociopolitical world, the middle 15% or so. Within Christianity, you're looking at more like, if fully left is 100, then you're looking at like, I don't know, the 70th to 85th percentile or something like that. Because conservative Christianity is so much bigger numerically than liberal Christianity.
Right.
But, you know, wherever you want to put those sliders of that sort of persuadable middle, that's what I'll be looking for.
Yeah.
And there are schools. I mean, Fuller Seminary is one like that. But one of the things that Tony Jones said on our episode that at this point will have come out last Thursday was like, there aren't a lot of those schools anymore. Fuller is in some sense standing on its own. Wheaton used to try and do something in the middle. They've become more conservative in a lot of ways. Like there aren't a lot of those institutions, but there still are a lot of those churches, and there are still a lot of those pastors, I would say, especially the younger you get.
Yeah. Yeah, that's helpful. And I agree. I've been learning from some friends how like theological seminaries like that are really struggling for students or struggling for funding. Yeah. And it's a major crisis in those spaces, frankly. And yeah, you know, I really, it's tough because a lot of my focus and a lot of my work's focus is really studying the white evangelical space. I mean, that in the sense of like how it's measured on like surveys and stuff, you know. And in that space, I mean, the data that I've read, especially most recently when it comes to PRRI, Robert Jones, and things like with Andrew Whitehead, is that about 70%, almost 66% of those folks are in the space of Christian nationalism, either being a sympathizer to it or adherent to it. Yeah. And so, you know, I just don't know, like, because whether we like it or not, this topic, it's all intertwined with political ideology and theological and cultural identity that I don't. Richard Hayes obviously influences influencers, right? In the sense of like, I don't know. I didn't know who he was, but people like you and Trip Fuller and others were like, oh my gosh, Angela Parker, I was mentored by Richard Hayes for a little bit. Like, so that's his world, right? I don't know if this book will trickle down immediately to them, but it might trickle down to some pastors, right? Who maybe aren't actual gatekeepers, but who are like, whoa, I'm going to reconsider this and talk to my congregation about it. The question is though, will these white evangelical spaces accept it or reject it because it's so tied to their political identity, and the language of wokeism or groomer is so tied to queer identity, right? And so it's going to be very interesting to see how this shakes out, because I think about actually in Russell J. Hawkins' book, The Bible Told Them So, he talks about how a lot of clergy were actually integrationists. And when they told their congregations that, their churches were dismantled. People just left. They just left their churches. So it came from the rank and file.
That's what happens now with LGBTQ affirmation.
Totally.
Yes. The rank and file ultimately have the power. That's true. Right. I think though that like, so it might be worth contrasting America with Russia. Like in Russia, being anti-LGBTQ is like synonymous with, to the extent that I understand it, as a global, you know, global culture correspondent. But like Putin has made a big point of like tying that to Russian nationalism, to the Russian Orthodox Church, to this conservative, like almost barbaric way of seeing the world.
Yes.
There are people doing that here, but it is not, it's not the same, because you do have these like, you know, groups of like gay men who like Trump. And even though Trump kowtows constantly to evangelicals. If you ask people, what does Trump think of gay people? Even his supporters know he doesn't give a shit. Like, yeah, it's not important to him.
No, you're right. You're right.
And so it's not quite like, yes, they're Christian nationalists or Christian nationalist adjacent. That does not necessarily include a queer sexuality element. Mm. I think you could have someone who is still concerned about wokeism, yeah, you know, or however they want to define that. Right. I have concerns, right, about, you know, some of the questions around public school curricula and stuff like that. Like, I think, sure, they're legitimate questions. Mm-hmm. I asked a friend of a friend in the city that we are moving to. I asked him about it before my kids enroll in public school there. I have some questions about it. That, sure, is not to say that I think that God hates gay people. Like, those are really far apart.
Right. Right.
And you could have any number of stops along the way. And so I would say, yeah, that is something to look for. And it is another item that I wanted to mention, but it is not one-to-one. And that one's not binary. There, yeah, is a decent spectrum there.
Well, it's frustrating that you even have to qualify that you're just being a parent. I mean, any parent hopefully would call their public school and ask for anything. Hey, when our oldest, he's in early intervention preschool for speech therapy. And I asked them, I hated asking this question, but I said, so if there's an emergency where there's someone who wants to do damage at that school, if you catch my drift, what's the plan? Like, how far is your police? I wanted to know. And it's a shame that because, you know, of how the far right space has hijacked this, you know, groomers are in public schools, that anyone who just wants to ask very normal questions like, hey, what does your sex ed look like? Hey, what books are you using? Which are good parental questions to ask. We have to clarify, like, it's not because we hate gay people. Like, it's not related at all to that. Yeah. We just want to make sure that we're involved in the process as our kids are getting educated, which is a good and normal thing to do. But anyway, yeah, that makes sense. I definitely could be so far in the weeds in some of these more, you know, like conservative turning point adjacent spaces.
You pay way f-ing more attention to that than I do, Tim.
I pay. I mean, I've been to those events, you know,
And it's real, but
it's so real.
The speakers aren't a one-to-one representation of all the voters, right? Like, just like it's not true on the left, like the way that conservative, you know, family members and other older folks who watch Fox News, like the way that the kind of questions they ask me about living in Seattle, like during Chaz and Chop and all that stuff, right? Like,
yeah,
it betrays a worldview that has been very shaped by this media that they consume.
Right.
Right. And they, like, the type of world that they think I live in as a liberal is a caricature, right?
Right.
And to some degree, if we just focus on the right wing watch, loudest voices, the biggest splashes on social media, then we will get a similarly skewed perspective of what conservative people's lives are like. You know, as if people are walking around governed by Charlie Kirk. Right. Mostly they're not. They're going to work. They're going to church. They're going to the local diner. You know, they're going to their kid's baseball game is what they're actually doing. And then they hold some views that I think are not good and are harmful, especially at the systemic level. But like, just like they think that I'm down there with a fucking blowtorch and megaphone in the Capitol Hill Autonomous Zone, I'm not. I'm watching Seinfeld reruns.
Right.
Throwing a ball with my son. I'm not doing that. You know, so there's that danger.
Hi, friends. My name is Josh Scott. I'm the lead pastor of Grace Point Church in Nashville, Tennessee. Over the last several years, we've witnessed an alarming rise in hate, violence, bigotry, and nationalism here in the U.S. And it's all been fueled by and bound up with this distorted misunderstanding of the teachings of Jesus. These are critical days we're living in. This is literally an all hands on deck kind of moment. We must support the voices that are pushing back on these dehumanizing narratives and working instead for love, compassion, peace, and inclusion. That's why I'm so grateful for the work being done through Project Amplify, because they're doing just that. They are seeking to amplify voices and messages that resist these toxic and harmful narratives and offer a hopeful vision of our future in their place. If you think this work is important too, then we must join together and support it. Click the link below to contribute to this important cause now.
Here's where I wrestle with this. I know we're a little off topic, but I don't care. This is a great discussion that needs to go here. So on
follow
one
the
hand,
heat,
right,
Tim, we follow that heat.
Yeah. Hey, the audience wants long conversations, Dan. We're going to give them what they want, damn it. On one hand, I struggle with mainly a lot of these mega church pastors being like, hey, Charlie, come speak at our event, at our platform.
Yeah,
right.
And
Charlie,
yeah.
And Charlie is just ignorant. Like, he's a very ignorant Christian. Okay. He just says stuff where I'm like, bro, I'm not a biblical scholar, but even I know that's garbage. Right. And then he's on church platforms with 10,000 people. So I struggle with that and like how these pastors justify why this guy should be in front of their audience. You're also right, though, in the sense of my parents are very conservative people. I grew up on talk radio my entire life, Okay. Rush Limbaugh, Sean Hannity, Michael Savage. Yeah. I can give them all to you.
We had Michael Savage books on my parents' dresser. Yeah. Year of the Rat with Bill Clinton in China on the cover.
Then you understand. I grew up in a very conservative home where my parents voted how you would expect.
Yeah.
And my dad and mom would even say that they would hold to complementarian roles. But their actual function, when I think about it, is actually quite egalitarian. My mom runs the entire business. My dad can't keep his head on straight. When my mom goes away on vacation.
All the time.
And like, for example, I watched my parents pay people's mortgages who were in need. My parents were super generous. I was never abused. Now, that's not everyone's story. I totally get that. I had a really healthy life. My dad would tell me, I hate paying taxes, but it's a sin to lie, so we got to pay them. Like, that was how my dad treated this stuff, right? Yeah. While also listening to Rush Limbaugh. My dad would have Sean Hannity on talking about illegal immigrants and how they're taking jobs while trying to learn Spanish to talk to the people on the construction site, right? Just trying to get to know them. And it's a real mind twist, bro, because you're right. You're right.
A man of, like most humans, your parents were people living contradictions.
Totally.
I mean, you want to get slightly therapeutic for a second.
Go ahead. Yeah, I'm in therapy.
Okay. No, I'm not your therapy.
Okay.
We would call this psychoeducation.
I want some free therapy, Dan.
No. I mean, maybe not on air.
Okay.
No, that's unethical. So it's called multiple relationships. Internal family systems. Have you ever interviewed anybody talk about internal family systems?
I have not.
Okay. I'm not going to get in the weeds here, but basically there is a form of therapy that is founded on this idea that just like in a family system, you have different people who play different roles to keep the system going as a whole. We have an analogous thing within ourselves. And the way that they talk about this in IFS is the parts of ourselves.
Mm.
And everyone has different parts. I have a part of me that is the same 17-year-old punk rocker, the system, class warrior. I have that part. Also, I have the mortgage paying, thinking about my 401k part.
Totally.
I have both.
I can relate, Dan. I can relate.
Okay, exactly, right? Dad has the part that's like, well, if I'm going to be listening to anything that has to do with sort of social questions, political questions, I'm a Rush Limbaugh guy. And he also has this other part that's like, these men, these workers who speak Spanish, like I have to get in better touch with them in order to be a loving person. And like, he's got both and they don't always line up.
No.
And that is true of every single person. And in fact, now I'm riffing. This is not IFS stuff, but me riffing.
Yeah.
You could argue that the person who thinks they have no contradictions, who tries to be holy and perfectly one thing, that's the dangerous person because they become an ideological zealot. And, you know, we're pretty comfortable with the zealots that we agree with.
But totally.
Don't get me around Westboro Baptist, buddy.
Right.
Like, that actually there is something about the tension within the parts of ourselves that makes us healthier humans. There can be too much tension, and that's what a lot of IFS work will work on. Like, we do want to, in a lot of modern therapy, not just IFS, but even just more humanistic therapy like I practice, we want integration. We don't want fundamental, you know, completely incompatible things. Like that's not a healthy and thriving situation. But there will always be some tension between these parts of ourselves because they are responding to different things. We have different needs, different desires, different parts of our story. And like, that's normal.
I listen, I know you aren't giving me therapy, but I feel so seen right now because you're in my head. I still feel like I have the mohawk. I feel like a f- the system guy.
You still have
I
the think tattoos about, at least.
You I just got a 6-hour chest piece done. I'm a man. Yeah, I'm a tough guy. And then I'm like with my kids, like goo goo gaga. I'm crying just thinking about it, that they're going to grow up one day. I have a mortgage to pay. I think about healthcare, right? I hate capitalism in so many ways, but also I'm trying to make a living and thinking about retirement.
You don't hate it that much.
Exactly.
Nonprofit organizations are a function of a fully functioning capitalist economy.
Great.
You can't have them without it, right? At least the way we do them now. I'm sure there's, yeah.
Yeah, for sure. And like, I did feel starting this work when I thought about, could I do this for a living? I felt damned if I do, damned if I don't. Meaning if I do Patreon or if I do like, hey, it's behind a paywall, that felt icky. But also like asking people just to give me money so I can survive also felt kind of weird. Like there was just no good answer besides here's me being honest. I'm uncomfortable asking you for donations. Also in the tension, if you like the work we do and you want more of it, here's what we need to make it happen, right? So
do you feel guilty about paying money for your favorite sandwich?
No.
Do you think that sandwich maker is conflicted about charging money for the sandwich that they make for you?
Probably not.
Yeah. I think we could learn a little bit from our favorite sandwich makers, our local delis.
Or in my case, McDonald's. No, I'm just kidding. No.
If that's your favorite, then there's a whole other host of issues to deal with. And you do need some therapy.
I'm really glad that we actually kind of went here. I think what you call that's really important because I do struggle with priding myself on being consistent and having no contradictions. Then I feel weird or guilty for having contradictions or actions that don't always line up. But you're right. We're human. Like we're complicated beings and it doesn't always make the most logical amount of sense, but it just is what it is. Like my dad is such a great example. I tell people often, me and my dad are the same ingredients, but we were baked so differently with such a different result, right?
Like,
oh,
that's interesting.
I have the same, like my integrity comes from my dad, my sense of value, my sense of hard work, my sense of truthfulness and transparency comes from my dad. And we have mirror responses to political issues, to cultural issues, to how we perceive or people that we see as authoritative sources of information, right? And we feel just as strongly about each other's perspective in the opposite way, but I'm still so much my dad. Like I am so much him. So it's just fascinating to witness. And I know this is something that I think as you get older and you have kids, you just start realizing like how much of your parents are inside of you, even if you express it so differently, how they still shape a lot of how you see the world and how you think about things. But yeah, it's just a very interesting place to be, I think, realizing that the world is not binary. Humans are not binary. We're complicated. And maybe it's, and I'm not sure if this is the right term, but maybe it's about being comfortable or being, you know what? I acknowledge I'm a contradiction sometimes and I'm okay with that.
I do think moving towards integration is good. Like if I could change that about your dad and have him stop listening to, you know, Fox and Limbaugh and all that stuff, like that would probably be better, I think.
I would agree.
But that's not to say that there's nothing of value there and that there's nothing for you to learn from him, despite the fact that he still does listen to that, right?
Totally.
And maybe this is actually kind of a cool place to wrap it back to the Hayeses and wrap things up is that two things. Number one, they wrote this book as a father-son pair. And that's kind of interesting in light of what you were just talking about. And I would put money on that the son had something to do with the father changing his mind.
100%.
And that's probably in part why they wrote the book together. That's a guess. I don't have any advanced knowledge of that. If not, what a fucking, you guys whiffed on that one. That was an easy home run. Should have written about that if you didn't. But then secondly, that like, can we apply this thinking to Richard B. Hayes? He's now in his 70s. There are different parts of him, even in the moral vision of the New Testament, which I ultimately disagreed with when I read it 10 years ago. There was tension there. He was describing, you know, I hold this view based on the text, But most Christians who hold this view are not compassionate and not loving. They do not act toward queer people the way Jesus commands us to do in the text, even the way Paul commands us to do in the text. And so there's tension, and now he's changed, and mm-hmm. another part of himself has maybe won out in that. And how will he square that with the Bible? And this is interesting. This is interesting stuff. It's yeah. only not interesting if you are pre-committed to a particular outcome.
Yeah.
And, you know, I recognize what I mean there is not pre-committed to an outcome around the issue. Like, I will read the book already committed to my view.
But right.
pre-committed to a vision of how people might change and grow.
Yeah.
If you are open to the world as you find it, then you will be surprised and hopefully enlightened and, you know, more depth and, yeah. And yeah, just like more detail to savor and feel in awe about.
Well, we got about 5 months till this book comes out. So, you know, I'm sure yeah. that this is going to come back up. I'm going to try and get Richard on the podcast. I'm sure you're going to try and talk to him as well. You know, I mean, I'm sure he's going to be very high in demand, yeah. but I'm going to swing the bat hard, you yeah. know, but I want to yeah. get him on the podcast. I want to get the
you're
book to talk
try
to
and
him.
Bribe yeah. him?
Yes, whatever it takes, whatever it takes.
How do you bribe a 72-year-old yeah. New Testament yeah. ethicist?
What do you want, buddy? You know, what do you want?
I don't even know. Like, what are they even... I don't even
if
know. They get, got all the books.
If I can
they
get can, father and son on, that's it right there.
Find out, okay, find out like what baseball team he likes or something, and like yes. say we got some tickets with your name yes. on it. That's maybe the way. I bet he likes a good baseball game.
Yeah, he probably does. I mean, these white men scholars must, because Pete Enns is a huge Yankee fan. You know, yeah, look at Pete
white,
Enns.
White men
huge
of a certain age.
The baseball
yeah,
players.
Enns, are, exactly. Yeah.
Fan. Anyway, yeah. Dan, this was a great yeah. conversation. I mean, baseball I think fan, I yeah. think this is a great start, at least on my end, to have this so like good. Two-part series. I think there's a lot for the audience to consider, even some things beyond yeah. The topic at hand. Where can folks on my end find your work if they want to hear more? Do you have a public presence, Instagram, Twitter, podcast, etc.?
Yeah, I'm starting to take things a little more serious over at Instagram. I'm having some fun posting some reels, trying some things out. That's Dan Coke, Coke like the drink, COKE on Instagram. And then you have permission anywhere you get podcasts.
Awesome. Sweet. Well, friends, thanks for being here. Friends of Dan's podcast, thanks for listening to Things on My End.
And Tim, please answer where people can find you for my listeners.
Right. I forgot the humble approach. Oh, yes. Thank you, Dan. Thank you so much. anywhere that the New Evangelicals can be found on the internet, meaning X or Twitter, whatever, TikTok, Instagram, Facebook, a website, thenewevangelicals.com. That's all us. My DMs on Instagram are open. You can always reach out to me, or you can email me at info@thenewevangelicals.com. I do my best to respond to everyone. I love talking to people and hearing from the wow. audience. So that's where you can find me. So cool. Well, this will be out pretty soon. I can't wait for people to hear it and get the response. And Dan, we'll talk again.
Sounds good, man.
All right. See ya.